Absolutely. So the terms overdose is often interchangeably used with poisonings or drug toxicity, but you may think that they have different meanings, but they generally mean or imply that the person took too much of a known substance, either intentionally or unintentionally. And it's often is a term to describe a situation where a person is harmed by the use of these substances. And I think this is an extremely important topic because without treatment and without emergency care, some of these patients would get into a situation where critical life functions, such as breathing and maintenance of heart rate and blood pressure and body temperature, is compromised to the point where the body can be in a situation for a prolonged period of time where it doesn't receive enough oxygen, and permanent damage, especially neurological damage, can be done. And this is something I think that everyone, not just university students, should be aware of. I think one of the things that people should know that at situations like parties or where substances are being used, they need to be aware that certain people will get into an unfortunate situation where they've had too much, or that the effect of the drug, which they may not be even aware of exactly what they're taking, or it could be a mix of drugs,
Of
which is
course.
even a little bit more confusing, where they will get into a condition which one will recognize as that this is not right, and there's something happening here, and this person is certainly in an emergency situation.
Right, okay. Well, that's very helpful. And I suppose to make it a little bit more specific, what are the key warning signs you would say, for instance, of an opioid overdose that somebody might observe? Potentially, what should they recognize immediately, and how should they respond to that?
So, opioid overdoses is what we are most commonly hear about. And the signs and symptoms are usually when the person becomes unresponsive or very, very obtunded, where they can't be woken up, even by yelling at them or pinching them on the shoulder or giving it a bit of a shake. So, they become unresponsive. But the key aspect that one should be looking for is that their breathing has become very slow, very shallow, or irregular. And sometimes it can be accompanied with snoring respirations or gurgling sounds, or even the sounds of them choking. And they may look very pale or cold, and their lips may turn blue. And but one of the key things that we look for as clinicians is for the size of the pupils, which usually in an opioid poisoning, they're very, very tiny, almost pinpoint.
Okay. I think that's been very helpful, Dr. Yoon. Thank you so much. And just in contrast, to some other drugs, stimulants such as cocaine, for instance, what signs m might somebody look for in that scenario?
And stimulant toxicity is certainly something that also very concerning, and you can see this in mixed overdoses. But we still see obviously a lot of overdoses related to stimulants such as cocaine or methamphetamines or what people have known as ecstasy, or designer amphetamines. So these are still being used, unfortunately. And you will often see them kind of in a kind of, I guess, colloquially, you could hear them as being overamped, or in such sort of mental distress that they have a lot of anxiety, restlessness, paranoia. And their behavior may become very bizarre, and they seem to be quite overworked, and These people are often dehydrated, and they may be sort of like engaging in very unsafe and risky activity. Sometimes they look like they're flushed and overheated. But those are all signs where emergency aid should be called for as well.
Right. Okay, no, that was very well explained. I think you did a really great job of illustrating that. Now, I know there are a few myths surrounding alcohol poisoning versus alcohol overdose that people often believe. What are some common misconceptions that you are aware of that you've perhaps come across in your practice?
I have to say the number one myth especially among young people, is that it can never happen to me. This is something like overdoses knows no boundaries, whether it's age or a certain environment or a socioeconomic level or a situation, or it doesn't matter. Overdoses occur everywhere. And there's lots of myths regarding, alcohol is a relatively benign substance because it's legal. It is not a benign substance. I think most of us, if not all of us, know of people who've gotten into very big medical trouble with respect to severe intoxication. And I think that's well known. But also, I think with the current drug crisis, one of the things that it is most bothersome to me is that people who feel like they're at a party and their friends or some associate gives them some sort of substance, that it is assumed to be safe. A lot of these substances that they get, from that are not from a controlled setting like a pharmacy or a hospital, you have no idea what's in those substances. You have no idea if it's a mix. You have no idea how lethal or how potent it is. You have no idea what kind of effect it will have on your particular physiology and your particular body. One dose, one ingestion may be lethal, and you have no idea. And that is where I think people should not have any sense of security if they get something given to them at a party or in an informal setting, like on the street, that in any way that it would be a safe substance to ingest or inject or inhale.
Yes, and I think Dr. Yoon, you make some really great points about that. I really like the fact that you mentioned some party safe advice right there, and I just wanted to ask you if somebody was in that situation per se, and they were to observe a potential overdose at an event or a party, what are some immediate steps that you would suggest for the individual to take?
So immediately that person, you should try to stimulate them to confirm that they are in trouble, that they are irresponsible. Like shout at them, use their name, pinch them or shake them on the shoulders. If the person doesn't respond, then that's a medical emergency. You should be either calling 911, or I'm not sure what the protocols on campus would be, but I imagine campus security would have some sort of emergency line to call. At that time, you should tell the 911 operator that you are beside a person with a possible overdose situation. And the 911 operator or whoever answers that call should be prioritizing that call as an emergency that requires emergency personnel to be by the patient's side as soon as possible.
Okay, that is excellent advice. And more specifically, in terms of we've discussed harm reduction a little bit and some party safe tips, but I was just wondering if you have any specific tips, for instance, that students could apply day to day if they were in those situations, perhaps to avoid initially, getting into such situations from the start.
So, there's a few things that I would say. One is be very aware of the things that you put in your body. If you get that kind of feeling that I don't know what this is, or you have some hesitancy, then absolutely back off. That is, taking any sort of substance that you're not completely 100% aware of what it is, and its dangers and risks and its effect on your own physiology, you should absolutely back away from. The other thing is that knowing your emergency procedures, and knowing what number to call. I think most people know to call 911 in the situation of emergency. I'm sure on campus there are training and signs and protocols to alert campus security to. But the other thing that I would really encourage everyone to know, if they don't know already, is how to do CPR. I think if you encounter anybody who, and it doesn't matter whether it's an overdose or not, that is breathing abnormally and you can't feel a pulse, that you should initiate CPR along with calling 911 or activating some sort of emergency help, or activating some procedure to get help as soon as possible.
Yes, and I most certainly agree with you on that, Dr. Yoon. I think just the ability to save a life is it's a really essential skill, and everyone can benefit from having some kind of a life-saving training, whether it's taking a BLS course or other such courses, or even just recognizing the signs of overdose. And you've done a really great job of just illustrating some of that today and just mentioning some tips and advice. So I really do appreciate that. And as we are coming to an end, I just wanted to ask you if you have any general wellness tips or closing remarks that you would like to leave listeners with today.
I do, and again, this is a very important topic, and I know that people probably know at least one person that has been affected by overdose, by substance abuse. It's a serious issue in our society and in our healthcare system. People do have heard of things like naloxone being an antidote for opioid overdose, but please know that naloxone has a kind of its role, but it's not the panacea to overdoses. People die of a lack of oxygen, not from a lack of naloxone, and it's important to support people's breathing and oxygen flow as the first principle before people think naloxone is the magic bullet that reverses any things. And there's many substances out there that people overdose on that where naloxone does not work. But please know that your 911 resource is extremely important, and there are fire department first responders and BC ambulance paramedics who are unfortunately very well experienced with managing overdoses, and they are the ones who will be the ones who will administer emergent and expert care right at the patient's side. And people should be aware of how to activate such services wherever they are.
Okay, and thank you so much again, Dr. Yuen, for all of your wonderful tips today. And I also want to say thank you again for coming in and taking this time to discuss this important topic with us. We're very grateful for this, and thank you so much.
Thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak today.
Some politicians love to tell us that we have to choose between policies that support people or policies that grow the economy. But we don't have to choose. A strong economy isn't only about stock markets and GDP. It's about all of us being able to afford our rent, our groceries, our medication. When we all thrive, the economy thrives too. Together, we can demand better. Take action at demandbettertoday.ca.
And thanks to Dr. Madia Khan for that great Health Matters segment. She'll be returning with more Health Matters segments over the coming months. So we look forward to those on our various Speak Up programs airing every Monday, every morning, every weekday morning at 10 a.m. on Tuesdays. Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. Next up, we have a great, a really fun, interesting story about the rediscovery of a long-lost garage band from Nanaimo. They put out a record in 1968, and it was recently rediscovered by Victoria-based music enthusiast Marcus Pollard, who was also spent many years as the sort of premier music promoter in the city and continues to be a big supporter of music. They rediscovered the music. This report will tell you more about that, but I wanted just to mention that Marcus Pollard is a friend of mine, and he recently posted on Facebook about how the record is really getting quite a lot of attention, not only locally, but across Canada and many publications in the States. So it's kind of like an exciting rebirth. Here's that story. And it'll be up in just half a moment. Anyway, I'm just waiting for it to load here. And there we go. So here's the story. It's about Nanaimo back 60s band, The Glass Cage.
This is a CHY News update. In the summer of 1968, performing a once-in-a-lifetime gig, a band, a bank around teenage boys, decided to record their live performance. An album that never saw the light of day. Until now. Flash forward to the summer of 2016, music aficionado Marcus Pollard of Victoria and his wife were visiting Portal Burnie. On the trip, he decided to visit his favorite consignment store, This and That. That is where he found an acetate record of an unknown psych rock band, The Glass Cage.
So yeah, I bought a bunch of kooky records, bunch of comic books, including this one that was an acetate, and it just said side one and side two on it. And it was $4, and it was trashed. So I said, well, of course, I have to get that. It's trashed. And that was it. About a couple of weeks later, I guess I got home and I just kind of tossed it on a pile. And then a couple of weeks later, I went and listened to it and went, holy crap, what the heck is this?
Having spent many years as a performer and booker in Victoria, Pollard says he has a good eye for seeing a spark in someone when they're still early on in their career. As a vinyl collector, he says he finds a lot of rare things. But he says 99 times out of 100, those things never leave a lasting impression on him.
But this, it just blew out of my speakers, and I've just thought, what the hell is this? I was listening to, who was it? Somebody was talking about the first Radiohead record, and they said, not the second one, which everybody likes, but the first one, she said, it just smelled like BO and teenagers. And that's kind of what this record to me sounded like. It just sounded like youth, you know, brawny boy youth. It was pretty cool.
From there, Pollard says he needed to find out who was involved in the young psych rock band. So he started looking.
I talked to dozens of experts in the field and collectors and archivists, and all of them went, no idea, no idea, no idea.
One day in 2018, on a post Pollard had made about the band on a Facebook page about Canadian music appreciation, he got a hit. Band member Norm Roth.
I thought he's going to ask me for my credit card and that we can get together, you know, or something like that, or he, you know. So I called him up and it all checked out.
Roth was one of the founding members of the Nanaimo-based band, The Glass Cage. Together with bandmates, 60 years earlier, he had written and sang the songs on the album. Then teenagers, Roth was the lead vocalist, Wayne Harbord was lead guitar, Clayton Millen was on bass, the late Terry Morrison was on keyboard, and the late Doug Hastings was on drums.
Well, old Pop, who made the recording, said, this is something you fellows will cherish for years to come, and we did.
That was Wayne Harbord, who came down to the CHY studio along with Clayton Millen and Pat Carpenter. Carpenter was one of the founding members of The Glass Cage, who was replaced by Harbord before they recorded the album. Carpenter says that in 1966, while he and Millen were 15 years old, the two boys decided to form the Glass Cage. Both were attending Nanaimo District Secondary School at the time.
The first guy that we got was Doug Hastings on drums. Clayton knew Doug. And, you know, we asked him if we could do a rehearsal or two. He sounded great, so that was a good start. He had a place, in those days they called it a rumpus room, a rec room down in the basement, you know, that we could practice in. So that was fantastic. We needed a lead singer, and Norm Roth was also at high school at the time. He was singing with a group that was kind of more folk-based called We Three, and he had a great voice, and so we asked him, you know, would you like to become part of the band? We were fortunate enough to get him. And then the last person we added, of course, was Terry Morrison on keyboards and backup vocals. And his previous band, which was called The Cry for Justice, had broken up. And so we jumped on that right away and asked him. And that was how the whole band came together.
Millen says as a band, they took their music seriously, wanting to make it big. They toured across the province, playing every show possible. Millen says shortly after Harbour joined the band, they took part in a Battle of the Bands event in Vancouver, where they took on the local band Winter's Green, a band increasing in popularity. That band would one day change their name to Trooper.
We lived on West 64th off of Granville Street, and Winter's Green would come over and spend a lot of time at our place, and plus the Collectors, who morphed into Chilliwack, and they would come over there. So we spent a lot of time, and we practiced like crazy all the time. And it was great fun. And we learned a lot, of course, because these guys coming over from other bands that were huge even at that time were really informative and gave a lot of information.
Then, when the band got invited to perform at the opening of the Fuller Lake Arena in Tremaine, BC, they knew this would be the perfect moment to finally record the music they have been playing for the last couple of years. Harbord says they got Jack Taylor, or Pop, as they called him, to come by and record their live set. Taylor owned the store, Sewing and Sound, on Nanaimo's Commercial Street, located where the Bank Rhode Conference Center now sits. Sewing and Sound was a store that he and his wife ran for sewing machines and music. Carpenter, who worked at the store after school, remembers Taylor's interest in audio recording. Taylor had a number of reel-to-reel recorders, which he used to record the band's performance.
And he was selling tape recorders, radios, all kinds of stuff, early cassette recorders. And at the time that he did this kind of recording, 8-track stereo was the big thing. Everybody had an 8-track machine in their car. You know, that was kind of the standard thing. And the 8-track tapes were probably, you know, about 6 inches by 4 inches. They're fairly, fairly big. But they would sound great in the car. You'd have speakers sort of set up in the back and the front.
The band recorded 5 of the original tracks, all written by Roth, as well as a cover of the Outside Woman Blues by the band Cream, and an outro jam session. But shortly after, as the boys and their band were getting older, their time as the Glass Cage came to an end, leaving the original recording without a proper release.
What did break up the Glass Cage? Well, it's a morphing process, basically. You just kind of decide on what you want to do. We changed the name again to Lemon, and we were going up and down the island doing gigs and that, but we were getting better and better, and people were telling us we were doing that.
Millen says he can't fully remember why the band broke up, but says it was just something that slowly morphed into everyone going their separate ways. So, in 1969, the Glass Cage, then called Lemon, came to an end. Or so they thought. In 2018, after first finding the album and meeting with the band, Marcus Pollard just knew he needed to get this album out to a wider audience.
I'm not a religious person, but I think that once I heard the record, and once I realized that nobody else had heard the record, I felt that it was a sin against nature if I didn't get this out to the world. I really did. I felt that that for me to turn my back on this and turn my back on these people who I had met, I felt I couldn't do it.
So Pollard teamed up with his friend Jason Flower, a musician and archivist out of Victoria who created the archival record label Supreme Echo. The two then started working to bring this 60-year-old recording to a modern audience, while Flower worked with a team in California and New York to boost the original audio to modern standards. Pollard started researching the history of the music scene in Nanaimo. He says he found that there wasn't much written about the music scene in Nanaimo during the 1960s.
There, nobody really seemed to know any of these bands. So I ended up, you know, writing a booklet for the record. It's about 5,000 words, but we got photographs of all of the bands, and just I hope that people in Nanaimo will, especially who were there, will be able to go, yeah, this is it. This was it. This was our scene.
Pollard was also able to commission Salt Spring Island artist Bob Massey to design the cover art for the album. He describes Massey as one of the greatest poster artists of the 60s and 70s, who's best known for making posters for bands like the Tragically Hip, David Bowie, The Doors, Pink Floyd, and even the legendary Woodstock Music Festival. Working on this project has been a worldwide success for the original band members, finally seeing their album released on vinyl for the first time. This past Sunday, the first of three album release parties were held for the Glass Cages album, Where Did the Sunshine Go? Carpenter says the album release party at Neptune Records in Vancouver was an amazing experience.
I actually couldn't believe the response. There is a whole kind of community of garage band, so-called aficionados, all over the world. And these guys have grabbed onto this. There were probably 60, 70 people who showed up in Neptune Records there, buying up copies of the record. We played it in the store, and everybody heard all the tunes. And it was just a great experience to meet everybody there.
Harbord says it's been great to get all the recognition from the work they did back in the 60s.
My youngest boy and my oldest son, they both heard the record on when they played a bit of it on YouTube. And they said, Dad, that's fantastic. We're not going to be a forgotten garage band. People will know who the Glass Cage was.
While Millen had to miss the first album release party due to illness, he says he is just so happy to see his album have its second chance in the sun.
Yeah, like we're not kids anymore. I mean, I'm 75 years old myself. So, you know, it's been a thrill. Everything morphs from one thing to another. And when it got to the end for me, I thought, okay, that's fine. I'm happy with what we did and how we did it.
Having the album finally be finished, Pollard says he feels so happy about how it turned out.
Jason and I had lived with this music for so long that we weren't really sure if it was great or not, you know, because we were kind of too familiar with it. So to see the world, literally the world, open up and go, yeah, this is as cool as you thought it was, is spectacular. And at the first party, the one at Neptune, it was all smiles, just ear to ear smiles. It was amazing to see. And these guys, you know, they're super spry, and they're all just, you know, being rock stars. Their record's getting reviewed. They've never had reviews before, you know. It's crazy. It's just, it's so satisfying.
Pollard says being at the first album release party was such a surreal experience, seeing everyone meet each other and hear the music again for the first time.
The keyboardist, Terry Morrison, he passed away in September, but his daughter showed up to the record release party, and she and I had been, I actually found her and just told her about the project and invited her to come. So you can only imagine what that would be like. Like, she'd never heard the music before, you know, and her dad is all over it. Like, his keyboard is all over the record, and 15 levels of gratifying. So, and that was, you know, watching her just sit there and cry happily listening to the music was a beautiful thing. So
the group is now gearing up for their last two album release parties on Saturday, February 21st at the Royal BC Museum in Victoria, and on Sunday, February 22nd, at the Vault Cafe in Nanaimo. The release party at the Royal BC Museum is already sold out. Vinyls of Where Did the Sunshine Go will be available for purchase at the release parties. Physical and digital copies of the album can also be purchased on the band's Bandcamp. While not all the members of the Glass Cage are able to see what has come of the recording, Carpenter says they are grateful for every second getting to celebrate the music they once all shared together.
I'd like to pay tribute to Terry and Doug, who were, of course, huge part of the band, and just pay tribute to them for their contribution.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Great story. Stay tuned for Democracy News coming up.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host.